Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I have been singularly impressed by the intelligence that a friend and colleague brings to bear on a variety of aspects of that war. He does so with a technical background, however, not so much a policy one, though he's pretty thoughtful about that too. Specifically, his expertise lies in the realm of understanding the implications for our electric grid, and therefore for our societies, of the sorts of threats that are now emerging and may well actually be upon us. His name is Thomas Popick. He is the chairman and president of the Foundation for Resilient Societies, an organization that I think is simply indispensable. His work there is, as I say, focused on trying to assure that we have a resilient society by making sure we have a resilient grid. Tom, in a previous life, served as an officer in the United States Air Force, completing a service with the rank of captain. He is also one of the lead authors of a terrific and highly important new paper, High Consequence Scenarios for North Korean Atmospheric Nuclear Tests. And he's here to talk with us about that and what it means for our grid and perhaps for our country and lives. Tom Popick, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be here.
Well, let me ask you to sort of first and foremost to talk about the possibility that the North Koreans might actually set off a nuclear weapon in the atmosphere. They have indicated an intent to do that. Is that right?
Well, they certainly have. I would point out something further, which is the North Koreans have declared that the capability for a super powerful EMP device is a strategic goal of their regime. Put the two things together, super powerful EMP capability, and second, a threatened atmospheric test. We're concerned that that atmospheric test may actually be a test of electromagnetic pulse capability.
So they've signaled their intention to acquire these kinds of capabilities at the very least, Tom Popick, and perhaps actually to use them. They seem to understand what the consequences would be for us on the ground of an EMP attack. But Tom, you've given some serious thought, you and your colleagues at the Foundation of Resilient Societies, about the impact that a test, say, over the Pacific might have for our assets in space as well. Would you walk us through some of those scenarios?
Certainly. When there's a high-altitude electromagnetic pulse detonation, it has multiple effects. First of all, it has effects on critical infrastructure within the line of sight on the ground. So that's first miniaturized electronics, but also any equipment with very long conductors, and that would include electric grid transmission lines, as well as long-distance undersea cables with fiber optics. But then there's another effect that people don't think about as much, and that's on satellites in low Earth orbit.
Well, before we get to that, Tom, just to stay with the terrestrial stuff that would be affected, I think the thought has been that if they detonate a nuclear weapon out in the far reaches of the Pacific, that there wouldn't be that much within line of sight. Explain what's wrong with that assessment.
There's a lot wrong with that assessment. We actually spent quite a bit of time developing potential EMP test scenarios that the North Koreans might undertake. We looked for areas in the Pacific where there would be minimal impact. We came to the conclusion there are no low-risk or low-impact opportunities for high-altitude EMP tests in the Pacific. There's a couple of reasons. First of all, there's islands in the Pacific, such as Guam, that has infrastructure on it. For example, the above-ground landing stations for the undersea telecommunication cables. But even if the test were to be conducted just over open ocean, there's this crisscross pattern of these undersea cables in the Pacific, and it's very difficult to avoid. If these cables were to be taken out, international trade is dependent on this type of communications.
So I've understood that these, you know, high power lines that we see crisscrossing the United States could be conductors for this so-called long wavelength phenomenon. But Tom, I honestly didn't know that fiber optic cables could have that same effect. Is that actually the case, that it would transfer the pulse through it to things that you want to protect, like, say, transformers or other assets at the other end?
Well, thank you, Frank, for that excellent question. A lot of people would understand that fiber optic cables use glass to transmit the signals, glass fibers. And people who've had just a little bit of physics training would understand that, that glass is not a conductor. However, the fiber optic cables cannot transmit much longer than about 100 kilometers without needing a repeater or an amplifier midway. As a matter of fact, there's multiple repeaters in these long undersea cable runs. The repeaters need electricity for energy to amplify the signal, and this electricity is provided by a power lead that runs the length of the cable. These power leads do conduct electricity, and they also can conduct the electromagnetic pulse, and that is the source of the problem with the undersea cables. It's not the fiber optics themselves, but the repeaters or amplification.
So move to the satellite issue, because that's something that I think very few of us are contemplating, but this could be a catastrophe, could it not?
Well, sure. The biggest effect for satellites in low Earth orbit, these satellites can be affected immediately by the X-rays from a nuclear detonation, but also nuclear detonations at high altitude dislodge electrons from their orbits among the atoms in the upper atmosphere. And these electrons then can collide with the satellites. Over a period of time, the collisions with the free electrons harm the sensitive electronics in the satellites and cause premature failure. As a matter of fact, after the 1962 Starfish Prime high-altitude EMP detonation conducted by the United States, a large percentage of the satellites in low Earth orbit failed within just a few months of that test.
So if the North Koreans were to act on the threats that they've made, not to attack the United States proper, but to detonate a nuclear weapon in space, calling it simply a test of their capabilities, this would have effectively the kind of destructive impact on assets of this country that would be constituted an attack on the homeland itself. Would that be fair?
I think that that's a fair statement. If the high-altitude EMP burst were to be over a U.S. territory, for example, Guam, even Johnson Island, the location of the Starfish Prime test is certainly a U.S. territory. So yes, a North Korean EMP test over a U.S. territory that affected infrastructure beneath certainly would be a very provocative act.
And again, depending on the height of burst, they would have a line of sight that would extend quite far out. If they were actually to detonate it outside of the atmosphere, Tom, would all of the kinds of consequences that you have talked about eventuate as well, from undersea cables to satellites in space?
That's a very good question. There's a range of altitudes that enable electromagnetic pulse effects. Generally, that range would start at about 40 kilometers altitude and extend up to approximately 400 kilometers altitude. The effects are different depending on the altitude. So, for example, a detonation at 40 kilometers altitude would affect miniaturized electronics on the ground, but wouldn't affect long conductors, whereas a detonation at several hundred kilometers altitude would affect the long conductors as well as the miniaturized electronics.
Tom Popick, as I say, the work that you do at the Foundation for Resilient Societies is of singular importance. We ignore conclusions that you've been drawing about these threats at our extreme peril, and I want to commend to everyone your new paper on high consequence scenarios for North Korean atmospheric nuclear testing. Tom, quickly, how can people find this important new product?
Well, they can email us at info@resilientsocieties.org, and we'd be happy to provide a copy of the paper.
Check it out through your email contacts then. Tom Popick, again, thank you for the work you do. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, we'll talk with Diana West, a regular visit with her. We'll examine what is going on with Sharia's exemption, apparently, from sex abuse charges. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by Diana West, a longtime syndicated columnist and now a superb blogger at dianawest.net, the author of two best-selling books, one on the subject of the death of the grown-up, the other on American Betrayal, the Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. Diana West, it's so good to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Wonderful to be with you, Frank.
Good. Listen, I'm mulling an issue that I suspect has dawned on you as a student of both American culture and society more generally, and of course, the threat posed to it by what Andy McCarthy calls Sharia supremacism. And I'd like to connect some dots here, Diana, and just get your thoughts on it. Of course, there's a great deal of interest in and concern about the abuse of women by men in various positions, journalists, celebrities, politicians, notably John Conyers of Michigan just resigned from the House over the scandal that he's been implicated in. And yet, it does seem to me as though this institution known as Sharia has gotten almost completely a pass from feminists and others concerned about all of this kind of, misogyny, I guess is the technical term for it. What are your thoughts about the fact that this doctrine, this supremacist doctrine, really seems to institutionalize abuse of women, sexual abuse and physical abuse and the rest?
Well, Frank, you are trying to pull the curtain off on that man at the controls in terms of attempting to apply across the board morality and principle to this ongoing scandal climate. I mean, I think what you're really saying is that if the public sphere, the public square was truly concerned about the abuse of women, that we would be seeing an outcry against the institutionalized abuse of women that is codified by Islam. So you're absolutely right to bring that giant hypocrisy to the fore here. And I think it's also an important thing to keep in mind when we look at these fires of scandal consuming certain people and not others. There is a sense in which this is perhaps a controlled burn. I mean, we're also only seeing stories, for the most part, that do involve victims, adult victims, for the most part. James Levine has recently been let go or put on some kind of leave after revelations of a young man, now a 48-year-old man, who was a child, when he claims he was molested by Levine. But that's almost by the by and doesn't seem to be really connected with this particular vector of scandal.
But you're suggesting that there's a lot more of that probably going on than we've seen light of to date, but it's just not getting the attention that it deserves, as well as that afflicted on adults.
Right. Well, we know that. We know that also from Capitol Hill Page scandals, whereby we have seen this. We've seen stories discussed about Pentagon analysts, you know, with porn, all kinds of porn on their machines going back 10, 20 years. We've seen these kinds of reports come forward. We have not seen the kind of, you know, intense five-alarm fires burning across the board here. We're seeing a cell activity. A lot of these people are at the end of their careers, right? I mean, Matt Lauer's No Spring Chicken. John Conyers certainly has been around since practically the Communist Revolution, which was another part of his background. What I'm saying is that there is cell activity. There is hypocrisy. Islam should be first and foremost in the minds of anyone who has a mother, wife, or sister, or daughter, and wants to protect them from such abuse.
And to be specific about the kinds of abuse that are actually, if not obligatory, certainly have been condoned historically by Sharia supremacists, are things like wife beating, marital rape, female genital mutilation, child rape, child marriage. Diana, what is it that is causing that curtain to remain unparted as you see it?
Well, I think that this is, in a sense, as I said, it's kind of a controlled burn. You can't control everything, but this is, I'm feeling very manipulated in certain sense, the way it becomes almost entertaining. It becomes a matter of bread and circuses. We are looking at this, we are consumed by this, or at least the media is, and that's what we look at, whereby there's all manner of either much more serious female abuse the world over, including in this country where female genital mutilation is on the rise, etc. And yet we are being almost fed this steady diet of scandal. And look at our institutions. You know, our institutions are self-immolating from their own corruption. So we're looking at, you know, are we really paying enough attention to what's even more important than whether, you know, the casting couch in Hollywood is a public menace? I mean, this important, but is it the most important thing?
That's a really important insight. And I just want to tie in a related one, which is that our ability to speak about such things when it comes to Sharia specifically is under assault, as we discussed a lot. Elizabeth Sabadish Wolf, a friend of yours and mine, a very courageous woman from Austria, has been in town lately and has been raising and warning about what's happening in Europe as a precursor, a forecast, if you will, of what is certainly going to happen here, if not arguably, it's already occurring here. Talk a little bit about Elizabeth's travails and her insights.
Yes, well, Elizabeth is a great lady, and we owe her a debt of gratitude for taking the trouble to come here and try to tell our lawmakers, try to tell our thought leaders what has happened to Europe, which she considers essentially to be lost. The Islamization of Europe, of her own country, Austria, other countries in particularly Western Europe, after these decades now of the Hijra, the Islamic migration, is such that it is nearly impossible to imagine these countries reclaiming their cultures and their traditions and ever reconstituting themselves as the European nations that we grew up either visiting if we were lucky or reading about. And she is here to try to tell us that the same fate is ours if we do not take care and begin to essentially follow the agenda that Donald Trump ran on as president, which involved a serious halt or slowdown, certainly of Islamic immigration, Sharia adherents, as we often speak of them, people who come from these cultures and bring them with them. This would be not just Sharia. This is the violence, the abuse of women that we were talking about, the abuse of animals. We're seeing an awful lot of that coming out of either Islamic or other third world immigration. It just seems to be picking up like crazy. And I know this was always a terrible thing that our troops had to deal with when they fought in the Islamic world. There were great tensions between Americans, for example, and Afghan troops that were discussed over abuse of dogs, if you can imagine these sorts of things. So this is what Elizabeth is here to do. She's here to encourage us to continue speaking. People are afraid. We have our First Amendment, which she would like to see replicated in Europe. She and Geert Wilders have often spoke to this. However, we don't use it as well as they do. And this has always been the paradox that struck me for at least 10 years now, that while the Europeans, like Geert Wilders and Elizabeth, do not have First Amendment protections, they speak as God created them, as freely as they wish. And whereas we have these protections, and very few people in America, certainly in our political class, ever exercise them. So these are the kinds of things Elizabeth is doing.
I think exercise is such an important verb in that context, because it is like a muscle that will atrophy if you don't use it, especially when Sharia supremacists and their enablers on the left are working assiduously to do in our society, notwithstanding the First Amendment, exactly what they've accomplished in Europe. Indeed, they're extending European laws here through, you know, Google and Twitter and Facebook and the like. There's so much more to talk about in all these counts, Diana. I look forward to doing so with you next week. In the meantime, thank you so much for your contributions to our understanding of them today, and we'll look forward to talking with you then. Chris Farrell from the superb Judicial Watch organization joins us. He'll talk about America's deep state operating in Latin America and Hillary Clinton's campaign doing business as Robert Mueller's investigation. That and more. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined by Chris Farrell, one of the really superstar figures in an organization that is doing superstar work. He is the director of research and investigation at Judicial Watch. He has served on its board and been active in its affairs since 2002. He has been contributing mightily to the output of that organization that has helped in so many different cases do the work that Congress has largely failed to do in terms of oversight, often using as its enforcement mechanism something that is generally not at the disposal of the Congress, namely the courts, and doing so with very considerable effect. One of the things that has been, I'm sure, an extraordinary help to Chris Farrell in his work at Judicial Watch is his background in military intelligence. He served as a military intelligence officer in the United States Army, including a number of its senior studies and a lot of hard practice in the space. These are skill sets that are much in need at the moment, and largely, it seems, in short supply inside the government, so it's valued all the more. Chris Farrell, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It is so good to hear your voice and to have you be part of our team.
Thanks, Frank.
Let me ask you, Chris, about a subject that is getting scarcely any attention at all, but I know you've been following it, and I know you have an appreciation of its implications. Talk about what's been going on in Guatemala of late and the role that has been played in it by a fellow by the name of Ambassador Todd Robinson.
Happy to do so. In fact, I was down in Guatemala about a month ago doing some firsthand investigation, and I spent time actually meeting with the president, the vice president, the minister of foreign affairs, and the country's director of intelligence, because the challenges that President Morales and his inner circle face are those of a legitimate, duly elected government being attacked by what political scientists and unconventional warfare people would call a Maoist insurgency. And that Maoist insurgency manifests itself as a really unusual sort of hybrid. It's a combination of all the usual sort of leftist groups you might imagine, many of them backed by George Soros and his various tentacles, but also featured is a United Nations commissioner who's been sort of grafted onto the government. He's actually a Colombian who purportedly has ties to FARC, the terror group there. And this guy's name is Velasquez. He is this sort of supranational overlord who gets to call the shots with respect to claims of corruption in the government. No Guatemalan ever voted for him. He's just sort of been put in place there by the UN. He's a mischief maker, and he and a few others, to include Todd Robinson, who you mentioned earlier, an Obama holdover who's now purportedly slated to go on to Venezuela, but he's a hardcore careerist leftist out of the State Department. Velasquez and Robinson together, along with the Soros front groups, are trying to destabilize and delegitimize the lawfully elected government of President Morales and his administration. It's the Guatemalan version of what President Trump faces with the deep state. It's an attempt to subvert and overthrow a legitimate election.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like the American deep state at work in Guatemala. So there's a lot of talk about corruption. Are you satisfied that there's not much there, Chris Farrell, and that actually this is really about kind of a coup d'etat against the state, engineered in part by this U.S. ambassador, former U.S. ambassador, I guess, Todd Robinson?
Correct. I mean, you accurately characterized the nature of what's going on there. This is a sort of vicious, petty publicity stunt style justice where you hold a press conference to announce an investigation, but you never actually indict anyone or have any successful prosecutions. So the press conference, you know, smearing someone is a big event and everyone becomes hysterical. But then when you say, okay, where's the proof? What have you done? Where's the conviction? There are none. He is absolutely without success, this character, Velasquez. But in the interim, he's been successful in jailing any number of people, to include the president's brother and his son. And purportedly, these people are in jail because of, in one case, a $6,000 internal revenue claim error from more than a decade ago. And in the other case, because the person was going around giving Christmas baskets to various members of the administration. And so people are sitting in jail over incredibly petty, minor things.
So, Chris Farrell, just to bring this to a close, and I want to turn to the other topic we have for you. This ambassador of the United States has been pursuing with Soros and company a leftist overthrow of a friendly government, with obviously strategic implications for the United States in that part of the world. He's now, evidently, amazingly enough, going to be promoted, I guess, to an even more sensitive post, arguably, in Venezuela, another country that has been already afflicted with too much leftism. And yet, presumably, he will bring that same kind of agenda to bear there. What would the implications of that be, were he to be confirmed to that post?
It's a regional disaster in the making. I don't know who is purportedly in charge at the State Department, whether this is Tillerson or whether it's one of the Munchkins, one of the leftist operatives.
Tom Shannon, I think, is the name that comes to mind.
Yeah, I mean, there's any number of characters over there that are, you know, actively working to undermine the president. I can't imagine that the president or anybody of his ideological ilk, you know, the people that were voted for and elected, I can't imagine that they would deliberately select this guy because he's so almost notoriously disqualified for the position. Nonetheless, it appears that he has been selected to go into Venezuela. He might as well be a member of the Maduro cabinet. I mean, that's how far over to the left this guy is. He will not represent American interests well. The president will not be well served by his performance there. And it actually it throws more fuel on the fire of the whole region of northern South America and Central America, that entire sort of triangle or cone.
It's bad enough the way it is, and I can't imagine fueling the fire, as you say. Chris Farrell, well, we will be following this very closely and raising questions about this candidacy for a sensitive position at this particular time. I hope that his departure might bring some relief to Guatemala, but that's a subject for another day's conversation with you. I did want to, in our closing moment or two, ask you about this character, Peter Strzok, who is being, portrayed, I think rightly, as essentially a Clinton operative in the Mueller investigations, having played a similar role in the FBI previously. Just give us a quick sense of him and what his role suggests about this investigation by Bob Mueller.
Well, he's a key figure, and he has demonstrably been involved in all sorts of mischief with respect to the Mueller investigation, the Hillary Clinton email investigation. He was involved with General Flynn and that mess. And, you know, I can probably argue or make a case that, in fact, he should be placed under arrest and indicted. He should be arraigned and released on bail. But I believe that he has committed crimes, that this is not an administrative error or some sort of official misconduct, But I believe that there is an actual, or actually a series of crimes that have been committed. I believe that his conduct is so grave that he's either leading it or part of it. I think there's a conspiracy charge that could easily be found in what's been going on.
Well, Chris Farrell, this is a subject we will need to drill down on considerably more and at greater length with, I hope, you as well as others. Thank you again for the extraordinary work that you do at Judicial Watch. You and your team have really helped expose so much of the wrongdoing that's been taking place in official Washington, notably, but not exclusively, during the Obama years. And I look forward to our next conversation with you about all of that. Keep it up in the meantime, my friend. Thank you for joining us.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's a great pleasure to say we're joined by a friend and colleague of many years. These days, she runs a super organization up in New York City called the Anglosphere Society, which attempts to bring together the peoples of the English-speaking world and to do so to the benefit of freedom. And she did it with great effect yesterday in a splendid conference that was held in New York City, addressing the plight of persecuted Christians and what can be done on their behalf. It was an all-star cast, and to have her tell us a little bit about it, I'm very pleased to introduce Amanda Bowman. Thank you so much for joining us on short notice, Amanda. It's good to talk with you, and congratulations on your program yesterday.
Well, thank you very much, Frank. It was the second annual conference on this topic, and of course, the scenario has changed somewhat since last year when the issue was, you know, ISIS was still rampaging in Iraq and the concerns about Christians in camps, etc. The situation has changed somewhat now, and it's the issue of whether they are going to be able to be safe when they return to their homes, which have, of course, been destroyed, and get back to the life that they had before ISIS and before the anti-Christian movement, as it were, that was subsequent to the American involvement from 2003 onwards. So there are, in fact, only where there were about 1.5 million Christians in Iraq at the beginning of this century. They're now only around 250,000.
I know. It's stunning. It's simply a genocidal ethnic cleansing, religious cleansing, whatever you have. One of the highlights of it for me was a super and very passionate presentation right out of the box by former Congressman Frank Wolf of Virginia. It was a call to arms, I think it's fair to say, by a man who walked the walk and talks, of course, as well, and still does, by the way, not just in Congress. Just share a bit with us about Frank Wolf's comments, if you would.
Well, Frank Wolf is an astonishing man. His point really was, apart from it's the duty of all Christians and people who care about traditional values, whether it's minorities, Jewish or Rohingya or whomever, to support the oppressed, and it's our duty to do that. And I think the other thing that really moved me was, you know, he spoke about the indifference of the mainstream media to this plight of Christians and how that's contributed to the suffering, because nobody's paying attention. It's what, you know, Edmund Burke said about the triumph of evil. But he did it with, as you rightly pointed out, with a passion and the experience of a lifetime dedication to this issue. And he spoke very movingly about certain individuals who are unsung heroes in Iraq. He spoke about a nun who has lost everything and yet still continues to minister to people, to a woman who the spirit of forgiveness among these people towards their oppressors. A woman who, on her deathbed, would not renounce her Christian faith.
Right, the deep commitment to the faith, even at the point of imperiling their lives. And there were so many people who spoke from the vantage point of individuals and organizations, notably the Knights of Columbus and the Nineveh Reconstruction Project and the Nazarene.org and the like, who were on the ground, notably but not exclusively in the Middle East, trying to actually do something to help these people. And I was particularly touched, I have to say, by the conversation that took place, Amanda Bowman, between the Deputy Secretary of State of Hungary, Tristan Azbej, and Stephen Rushing. Just share with us very briefly, if you would, sort of that tale and the role that Hungary is playing. It's really sort of a model for the rest of us.
It is. And of course, they've been treated with vilification by a lot of the media who see that the fact that they have not opened their arms to limitless immigration on the Europeans, you know, in Europe, and have taken a stance that's very different from many of the EU countries. But their position has been that, you know, they're a small country, but what they can do is they can protect and support and defend the Christian community, and how important it is to do that at this present time when they're threatened with extinction.
But in situ, as they say, helping them get back not only on their feet, but in their homes. And some of the lengths to which Hungary has gone to do that in very short order, which is, again, exemplary for the rest of us. Amanda, let me just turn quickly to the sort of denouement of the program, the closing conversation between Cardinal Dolan, the Catholic Archdiocese of New York's cardinal, of course, and Ambassador Ronald Lauder, who is the president of the World Jewish Congress. This was really a quite fascinating repartee between these two men, both of whom are engaged in trying to address this problem.
That's right. And interestingly enough, I had them both separately last year as speakers, not speaking together. And as a result of what happened last year, the two of them met with me and asked us to collaborate and create a movement of concerned Christians in the United States across different denominations to really bring this issue and make it a priority of the United States government to protect these Christians, and that it's in the geopolitical interest of the U.S. to do so, to have this community that is educated, dedicated to free speech and the values that we all cherish within a country like Iraq, how important it is to have them, especially as that population has lost its Jewish minority some time ago. So it's very important. And Ronald Lauder, in my view, is a heroic figure. He has spoken out on behalf of Christians with a much louder voice than most Christians, and he's used his position as president of the World Jewish Congress to speak truth to power, and it's amazing. And as the cardinal pointed out, he held his feet to the fire.
Indeed. And you know, he made a very strong appeal for the church, both the Catholic Church specifically, and I think the church writ large, to become politically engaged in trying to address this problem, which I found both very necessary and a very evocative challenge indeed to us all. I just want to say, Amanda Bowman, of the Anglosphere Society, you and your co-sponsor Nina Shea with the Hudson Institute Center for Religious Freedom made a really signal contribution to my personal assessment and understanding and awareness of this problem, and I'm so grateful for it being able to participate. And I do wonder, I know the filming of it took place, will the video be available to a larger audience?
They will be able to find it at the Anglosphere website as well as at the Hudson website. anglosphere society.org.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, we will call further attention to it when it becomes available. But in the meantime, folks, check out the Anglosphere Society and, for that matter, Hudson.org as well. Amanda Bowman, thank you so much for your leadership. We'll look forward to talking with you again soon and to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.